Side 2, The Dark Half, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 44. There are people in the world who are quite good at lying to themselves, but Digger Holt wasn't one of them. That nervous, scoffing voice in his mind could not change what his eyes saw. He had tracked and hunted wild things all his life, and this sign was just too easy to read. He wished to Christ it wasn't. Here in this pile of dirt close to the grave was not only a footprint, but a circular depression almost the size of a dinner dish. This dimple was to the left of the footprint, and on either side of the circular print and the foot mark, but farther back, were grooves in the dirt that were clearly the marks of fingers, fingers which had slipped a little before catching hold. He looked beyond the first footprint and saw another. Beyond that, on the grass, was half of a third, formed when some of the dirt on the shoe which stepped there fell off in a clump. It had fallen off, but remained moist enough to hold the impression. And that's what the three or four others which had originally caught his eye had done. If he hadn't come so cussed early in the morning, while the grass was still wet, the sun would have dried the earth and it would have fallen apart in loose little crumbles that meant nothing. He wished he had come later, that he had gone out to Grace Cemetery first, as he had set out to do when he left home. But he hadn't, and that was all. The fragments of footprints petered out less than 12 feet from the grave, hole in the ground. Digger suspected the dewy grass farther on might still hold impressions, though, and he supposed he would check on that, although he didn't much want to. For the time being, however, he redirected his gaze to the clearest marks, the ones in the little pile of dirt close to the hole. Grooves which had been drawn by fingers, a round impression slightly ahead of them, a footprint beside the round mark. What story did that configuration tell? Digger hardly had to ask himself before the answer dropped into his mind like the secret void on that old Groucho Marx show, You Bet Your Life. He saw it as clearly as if he had been here when it happened, and that was precisely why he didn't want any more to do with this at all. Goddamn creepy was what it was. Because, look, here's a man standing in a new-dug hole in the ground. Yes, but how'd he get down there? Yes, but did he make the hole, or did someone else do it? Yes, but how come the little roots look twisted and frayed and torn, as if the sods were pulled apart with bare hands instead of sheared cleanly apart with a spade? Never mind the buts, never mind them at all. It was better, maybe, not to think of them. Just stick with the man standing in the hole, a hole that is a little too deep to just jump out of. So what does he do? He puts his palms in the closest pile of dirt and boosts himself out. No particular trick to that, if it was a full-grown man, that was, and not a kid. Digger looked at the few clear and complete tracks he could see and thought, if it was a kid, he had awful damned big feet. Those have got to be size 12s, at least. Hands out. Boost the body up. During the boost, the hands slip a little bit in the loose dirt, so you dig in with your fingers, leaving those short grooves. Then you're out, and you balance your weight on one knee, creating that round depression. You put one foot down next to the knee you're balanced on, shift your weight from the knee to the foot, get up, and walk away. Simple as knitting kitten breeches. So some guy dug himself out of his grave and just walked away, is that it? Maybe got a little hungry down there and decided to hit Nan's luncheonette for a cheeseburger and a beer? God damn it, it ain't a grave. It's a friggin' hole in the ground, he said aloud, and then jumped a little as a sparrow scolded him. Yes, nothing but a hole in the ground. Hadn't he said so himself? But how come he couldn't see any marks of the sort he associated with spade work? How come there was just that one set of footprints going away from the hole and none around it, none pointing toward it, the way there would be if a fellow had been digging and stepping in his own dirt every now and then, as fellows digging holes tended to do. It occurred to him to wonder just what he was going to do about all this, and Digger was goddamned if he knew. He supposed that, technically, a crime had been committed, but you couldn't accuse the criminal of grave robbing, not when the plot which had been dug over didn't contain a body. The worst you could call it was vandalism, and if there was more to be made of it than that, Digger Holt wasn't sure he was the one who wanted to do the making. Best, maybe, to just fill the hole back in, replace what flaps of sod he could find whole, get enough fresh sod to finish the job, then forget the whole thing. After all, he told himself for the third time, it ain't as if anyone was really buried there. In the eye of his memory, that rainy spring day glimmered momentarily. My, that gravestone had looked real. When you saw that willowy assistant carrying it around, you knew it was make-believe. But when they had it set up, with those fake flowers in front of it and all, you'd have sworn it was real, and that there was really somebody. His arms were crawling with hard little knots of flesh. "You just quit on it now," he told himself harshly. And when the sparrow scolded again, Digger welcomed its unlovely but perfectly real and perfectly ordinary sound. "You go on and yell, Mother," he said, and walked over to the last fragment of footprint. Beyond it, as he had more or less suspected, he could see other prints smashed into the grass. They were widely spaced. Looking at them, Digger didn't think the fellow had been running, but he sure hadn't been wasting any time. 40 yards farther along, he found his eye could mark the fellow's progress in another way. A large basket of flowers had been kicked over. Although he couldn't see any prints that far away, the basket would have been right in the path of the prints he could see. Man could have gone around that basket, but he hadn't chosen to do so. Instead, he had simply kicked it aside and kept on going. Men who did things like that were not, in Digger Holt's opinion, the sort of men you wanted to fuck around with unless you had a damned good reason. Moving diagonally across the cemetery, he had been as if on his way to the low wall between the boneyard and the main road. Moving like a man who had places to go and things to do. Although Digger was not much better at imagining things than he was at fooling himself, the two things, after all, have a way of going hand in hand. Digger saw this man for a moment, literally saw him. A big fellow with big feet striding through this silent suburb of the dead in the darkness, moving confidently and steadily on his big feet, booting the basket of flowers out of his way without even breaking stride when he came to it. He was not afraid either, not this man. Because if there were things here which were still lively, as some people believed, they would be afraid of him. Moving, walking, striding. And God befriend the man or woman who got in his way. The bird scolded. Digger jumped. "Forget it, chummy," he told himself once more. "Just fill the friggin' thing in and never mind thinking about it." Fill it in he did, and forget it he intended to. But late that afternoon, Deke Bradford found him out at the Stackpole Road burying ground and told him the news about Homer Gamache, who had been found late that morning less than a mile up from homeland on Route 35. The whole town had been agog with rumors and speculation most of the day. Then, reluctantly, Digger Holt went to talk to Sheriff Pangborn. He didn't know if the hole in the tracks had anything to do with the murder of Homer Gamache, but he thought he'd best tell what he knew and let those who were paid for it do the sorting out. Chapter 4 Death in a Small Town. 1. Castle Rock has been, at least in recent years, an unlucky town. As if to prove that old saw about lightning and how often it strikes in the same place isn't always right, a number of bad things had happened in Castle Rock over the last 8 or 10 years. Things bad enough to make the national news. George Bannerman was the local sheriff when those things occurred, but Big George, as he had been affectionately called, would not have to deal with Homer Gamache, because Big George was dead. He had survived the first bad thing, a series of rape strangulations committed by one of his own officers, but 2 years later he had been killed by a rabid dog out on Town Road Number 3. Not just killed either, but almost literally torn apart. Both of these cases had been extremely strange, but the world was a strange place, and a hard one, and sometimes an unlucky one. The new sheriff, he had been in office going on 8 years, but Alan Pangborn had decided he was going to be the new sheriff, at least until the year 2000, always assuming, he told his wife, that he went on running and being elected that long, hadn't been in Castle Rock then. Until 1980, he had been in charge of highway enforcement in a small, going on medium-sized city in upstate New York, not far from Syracuse. Looking at Homer Gamache's battered body lying in a ditch beside Route 35, he wished he was still there. It looked like not all of the town's bad luck had died with Big George Bannerman after all. "Oh, quit it. You don't wish you were anyplace else on God's green earth. Don't say you do, or bad luck will really come down and take a ride on your shoulder. This has been a damned good place for Annie and the boys. And it's been a damned good place for you, too. So why don't you just get off it? Good advice. Your head, Pangborn had discovered, was always giving your nerves good advice they couldn't take. They said, "Yes, sir. Now that you mention it, that's just as true as it can be." And then they went right on jumping and sizzling. Still, he had been due for something like this, hadn't he? During his tour of duty as sheriff, he had scraped the remains of almost 40 people off the town roads, broken up fights beyond counting, and been faced with maybe 100 cases of spouse and child abuse. And those were just the ones reported. But things have a way of evening out. For a town that had sported its very own mass killer not so long ago, he had had an unusually sweet ride when it came to murder. Just 4, and only one of the perps had run. Joe Rodway, after he blew his wife's brains out. Having had some acquaintance of the lady, Pangborn was almost sorry when he got a telex from the police in Kingston, Rhode Island, saying they had Rodway in custody. One of the others had been vehicular manslaughter, the remaining 2 plain cases of second degree, one with a knife and one with bare knuckles. The latter a case of spouse abuse that had simply gone too far, having only one odd wrinkle to distinguish it. The wife had beaten the husband to death while he was dead drunk, giving back one final apocalyptic tit for almost 20 years of tat. The woman's last set of bruises had still been a good, healthy yellow when she was booked. Pangborn hadn't been a bit sorry when the judge let her off with 6 months in women's correctional, followed by 6 years probation. Judge Pender had probably done that only because it would have been impolitic to give the lady what she really deserved, which was a medal. Small-town murder in real life, he had found, rarely bore any likeness to the small-town murders in Agatha Christie novels, where 7 people all took a turn at stabbing wicked old Colonel Storpinggoiter at his country house in Puddleby-on-the-Marsh during a moody winter storm. In real life, Pangborn knew, you almost always arrive to find the perp still standing there, looking down at the mess and wondering what the fuck he'd done. How it had all jittered out of control with such lethal speed. Even if the perp had strolled off, he usually hadn't gone far, and there were 2 or 3 eyewitnesses who could tell you exactly what had happened, who had done it, and where he had gone. The answer to the last question was usually the nearest bar. As a rule, small-town murder in real life was simple, brutal, and stupid. As a rule. But rules are made to be broken. Lightning sometimes does strike twice in the same place. And from time to time, murders that happen in small towns are not immediately solvable. Murders like this one. Pangborn could have waited. 2. Officer Norris Ridgwick came back from his cruiser, which was parked behind Pangborn's. Calls from the 2 police band radios crackled out in the warm late spring air. "Is Ray coming?" Pangborn asked. Ray was Ray Van Allen, Castle County's medical examiner and coroner. "Yep," Norris said. "What about Homer's wife? Anybody tell her about this yet?" Pangborn waved flies away from Homer's upturned face as he spoke. There was not much left but the beaky, jutting nose. If not for the prosthetic left arm and the gold teeth which had once been in Gamache's mouth and now lay in splinters on his wattled neck and the front of his shirt, Pangborn doubted if his own mother would have known him. Norris Ridgwick, who bore a passing resemblance to Deputy Barney Fife on the old Andy Griffith show, scuffled his feet and looked down at his shoes as if they had suddenly become very interesting to him. "Well, John's on patrol up in the View, and Andy Clutterbuck's in Auburn at District Court." Pangborn sighed and stood up. Gamache was, had been, 67 years old. He'd lived with his wife in a small, neat house by the old railroad depot less than 2 miles from here. Their children were grown and gone away. It was Mrs. Gamache who had called the sheriff's office early this morning, not crying but close, saying she'd wakened at 7 to find that Homer, who sometimes slept in one of the kids' old rooms because she snored, hadn't come home at all last night. He had left for his league bowling at 7 the previous evening, just like always, and should have been home by midnight, 12:30 at the latest, but the beds were all empty, and his truck wasn't in the dooryard or the garage. Sheila Brigham, the day dispatcher, had relayed the initial call to Sheriff Pangborn, and he had used the payphone at Sunny Jacket's Sunoco station, where he had been gassing up, to call Mrs. Gamache back. She had given him what he needed on the truck, Chevrolet pickup, 1971, white with maroon primer paint on the rust spots, and a gun rack in the back. Main license number, 96529Q. He'd put it out on the radio to his officers in the field, only three of them, with Clut testifying up in Auburn, and told Mrs. Gamache he would get back to her just as soon as he had something. He hadn't been particularly worried. Gamache liked his beer, especially on his league bowling night, but he wasn't completely foolish. If he'd had too much to feel safe driving, he would have slept on the couch in one of his bowling buddy's living rooms. There was one question, though. If Homer had decided to stay at the home of a teammate, why hadn't he called his wife and told her so? Didn't he know she'd worry? Well, it was late, and maybe he didn't want to disturb her. That was one possibility. A better one, Pangborn thought, was that he had called, and she had been fast asleep in bed, a closed door between her and the one telephone in the house. And you had to add in the probability that she was snoring like a Jimmy Pete doing 70 on the turnpike. Pangborn had said goodbye to the distraught woman and hung up, thinking her husband would show by 11 o'clock this morning, at the latest, shamefaced and more than a little hungover. Ellen would give the old rip the sandpaper side of her tongue when he did. Pangborn would thus make it a point to commend Homer, quietly, for having the sense not to drive the 30 miles between South Paris and Castle Rock while under the influence. About an hour after Ellen Gamache's call, it had occurred to him that something wasn't right about his first analysis of the situation. If Gamache had slept over at a bowling buddy's house, it seemed to Ellen that it must have been the first time he ever did so. Otherwise, his wife would have thought of it herself and at least waited a while longer before calling the sheriff's office. And then it struck Ellen that Homer Gamache was a little bit old to be changing his ways. If he had slept over someplace last night, he should have done it before. But his wife's call suggested he hadn't. If he had gotten shit-faced at the lanes before and then driven home that way, he probably would have done it again last night. But hadn't. So the old dog learned a new trick after all, he thought. It happens. Or maybe he just drank more than usual. Hell, he might even have drunk about the same amount as always and gotten drunker than usual. They say it does catch up with a person. He had tried to forget Homer Gamache, at least for the time being. He had yayed paperwork on his desk, and sitting there, rolling a pencil back and forth and thinking about that old geezer out someplace in his pickup truck, that old geezer with white hair buzzed flat in a crew cut and a mechanical arm on account of he'd lost the real one at a place called Pusan in an undeclared war which had happened when most of the current crop of Vietnam vets were still shitting yellow in their dighties. Well, none of that was moving the paper on his desk. And it wasn't finding Gamache, either. All the same, he had been walking over to Sheila Brigham's little cubbyhole, meaning to ask her to raise Norris Ridgewick so he could find out if Norris had found anything out, when Norris himself had called in. What Norris had to report deepened Allen's trickle of unease to a cold and steady stream. It ran through his guts and made him feel lightly numb. He scoffed at those people who talked about telepathy and precognition on the call-in radio programs, scoffed in the way people do when hint and hunch have become so much a part of their lives that they barely recognize them when they are using them. But if asked what he believed about Homer Gamache at that moment, Ellen would have replied, "When Norris called in, well, that's when I started knowing the old man was hurt bad or dead. Probably choice number two." 3. Norris had happened to stop at the Arsenault place on Route 35, about a mile south of Homeland Cemetery. He hadn't even been thinking about Homer Gamache, although the Arsenault farm and Homer's place were less than 3 miles apart. And if Homer had taken the logical route home from South Paris the night before, he would have passed the Arsenaults. It didn't seem likely to Norris that any of the Arsenaults would have seen Homer the night before, because if they had, Homer would have arrived home safe and sound 10 minutes or so later. Norris had only stopped at the Arsenault farm because they kept the best roadside produce stand in the three towns. He was one of those rare bachelors who liked to cook, and he had developed a terrific hankering for fresh sugar peas. He had wanted to find out when the Arsenaults would have some for sale. As an afterthought, he'd asked Dolly Arsenault if she had happened to see Homer Gamache's truck the night before. "Now, you know," Mrs. Arsenault had said, "it's funny you should mention that, because I did. Late last night. No, Now that I think about it, it was early this morning because Johnny Carson was still on, but getting toward the end. I was going to have another bowl of ice cream and watch a little of that David Letterman show and then go to bed. I don't sleep so well these days, and that man on the other side of the road put my nerves up. "What man was that, Mrs. Arsenault?" Norris asked, suddenly interested. "I don't know, just some man. I didn't like his looks. Couldn't even hardly see him, and I didn't like his looks. How's that?" "Sounds bad, I know, but that Juniper Hill Mental Asylum isn't all that far away. And when you see a man alone on a country road at almost 1 in the morning, it's enough to make anyone nervous, even if he is wearing a suit."
"What kind of suit was he wear?"
Norris began, but it was useless. Mrs. Arsenault was a fine old country talker, and she simply rolled over Norris Ridgewick with a kind of relentless grandiosity. He decided to wait her out and glean what he could along the way. He took his notebook out of his pocket.
"In a way," she went on, "the suit almost made me more nervous. It didn't seem right for a man to be wearing a suit at that hour, if you see what I mean. Probably you don't, probably you think I'm just a silly old woman, and probably I am just a silly old woman. But for a minute or two before Homer come along, I had an idea that man was maybe going to come to the house. And I got up to make sure the door was locked. He looked over this way, you know. I saw him do that. I imagine he looked because he could probably see the window was still lighted even though it was late. Probably could see me, too, because the curtains are only shears. I couldn't really see his face. No moon out last night, and I don't believe they'll ever get streetlights out this far, let alone cable TV like they have in town. But I could see him turn his head. Then he did start to cross the road. At least I think that's what he was doing, or was thinking about doing, if you see what I mean. And I thought he would come and knock on the door and say his car was broke down and could he use the phone. And I was wondering what I should say if he did that, or even if I should answer the door. I suppose I am a silly old woman, because I got to thinking about that Alfred Hitchcock Presents show where there was a crazy man who could just about charm the birdies down from the trees. Only he'd used an axe to chop somebody all up, you know, and he put the pieces in the trunk of his car, and they only caught him because one of his taillights was out, or something like that. But the other side of it was,
Mrs. Arsenault, I wonder if I could ask,
was that I didn't want to be like the Philistine or Saracen or Gomorrah, or whoever it was that passed by the other side of the road.
Mrs. Arsenault continued.
You know, in the story of the Good Samaritan. So I was in a little bit of a tether about it. But I said to myself...
By then Norris had forgotten all about sugar peas. He was finally able to bring Mrs. Arsenault to a stop by telling her that the man she had seen might figure in what he called an ongoing investigation. He got her to back up to the beginning and tell him everything she had seen, leaving out the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and the story of the Good Samaritan as well, if possible. The story as he related it over the radio to Sheriff Alan Pangborn was this. She had been watching The Tonight Show alone, her husband and the boys asleep in bed. Her chair was by the window which looked out on Route 35. The shade was up. Around 12:30 or 12:40, she had looked up and had seen a man standing on the far side of the road, which was to say, the Homeland Cemetery side. Had the man walked from that direction or the other? Mrs. Arsenault couldn't say for sure. She had an idea he might have come from the direction of Homeland, which would have meant he was heading away from town. But she couldn't say for sure what gave her that impression. Because she had looked out the window once and only seen the road, then looked out again before getting up to get her ice cream, and he was there. Just standing there and looking toward the lighted window. Toward her, presumably. She thought he was going to cross the road, or had started to cross the road. Probably just stood there, Alan thought. The rest was nothing but the woman's nerves talking. When lights showed on the crest of the hill. When the man in the suit saw the approaching lights, he had cocked his thumb in the timeless, stateless gesture of the hitchhiker.
It was Homer's truck, all right, and Homer at the wheel, Mrs. Arsenault told Norris Ridgewick. At first I thought he'd just go on by, like any normal person who sees a hitchhiker in the middle of the night. But then his taillights flashed on, and that man ran up to the passenger side of the cab and got in.
Mrs. Arsenault, who was 46 and looked 20 years older, shook her white head.
Homer must have been lit to pick up a hitchhiker that late, she told Norris. Lit or simple-minded, and I've known Homer almost 35 years. He ain't simple.
She paused for thought.
Well, Not very.
Norris tried to get a few more details from Mrs. Arsenault on the suit the man had been wearing, but had no luck. He thought it really was sort of a pity that the street lamps ended at the Homeland Cemetery grounds, but small towns like The Rock had only so much money to do with. It had been a suit, she was sure of that, not a sport coat or a man's jacket, and it hadn't been black, but that left quite a spectrum of colors to choose from. Mrs. Arsenault didn't think the hitchhiker's suit had been pure white, but all she was willing to swear to was that it hadn't been black.
"I'm not actually asking you to swear, Mrs. A," Norris said. "When a body's speaking with an officer of the law on official business," Mrs. A. replied, folding her hands primly into the arms of her sweater, "it comes to the same thing."
So what she knew boiled down to this. She had seen Homer Gamache pick up a hitchhiker at about 12:45 in the morning. Nothing to call in the FBI about, you would have said. It only got ominous when you added in the fact that Homer had picked up his passenger 3 miles or less from his own dooryard, but hadn't arrived home. Mrs. Arsenault was right about the suit, too. Seeing a hitchhiker this far out in the boonies in the middle of the night was odd enough. By 12:45, any ordinary drifter would have laid up in a deserted barn or some farmer's shed. But when you added in the fact that he had also been wearing a suit and a tie, "some dark color," Mrs. A. said, "just don't ask me to swear what dark color, because I can't and I won't," it got less comfortable all the time.
"What do you want me to do next?"
Norris had asked over the radio once his report was complete.
"Stay where you are," Alan said. "Swap Alfred Hitchcock Presents Stories with Mrs. A. until I get there. I always used to like those myself."
But before he had gone half a mile, the location of the meeting between himself and his officer had been changed from the Arsenault place to a spot about a mile west of there. A boy named Frank Gavineau, walking home from a little early fishing down at Strimmer's Brook, had seen a pair of legs protruding from the high weeds on the south side of Route 35. He ran home and told his mother. She had called the sheriff's office. Sheila Brigham relayed the message to Alan Pangborn and Norris Ridgwick. Sheila maintained protocol and mentioned no names on the air. Too many little pitchers with cobras and bearcats were always listening in on the police bands. But Alan could tell by the upset tone of Sheila's voice that even she had a good idea who those legs belonged to. About the only good thing which had happened all morning was that Norris had finished emptying his stomach before Alan got there, and had maintained enough wit to throw up on the north side of the road, away from the body and any evidence there might be around it.
"What now?" Norris asked, interrupting the run of his thoughts.
Alan sighed heavily and quit waving the flies away from Homer's remains. It was a losing battle.
"Now I get to go down the road and tell Ellen Gamache the widowmaker paid a visit early this morning. You stay here with the body. Try to keep the flies off him."
"Gee, Sheriff, why? There's an awful lot of them, and he's..."
"Dead, yeah, I can see that. I don't know why, because it just seems like the right thing to do, I guess. We can't put his fucking arm back on, but at least we can keep the flies from shitting on what's left of his nose."
"Okay," Norris said humbly.
"Okay, Sheriff." "Norris, do you think you could call me Alan if you really worked on it, if you practiced?"
"Sure, Sheriff, I guess so."
Alan grunted and turned for one last look at the area of the ditch that would, in all probability, be cordoned off with bright yellow crime scene do not cross tapes attached to surveyor's poles when he got back. The county coroner would be here. Henry Payton from the Oxford State Police Barracks would be here. The photographer and the technicians from the Attorney General's Capital Crimes Division probably wouldn't be, unless there happened to be a couple of them in the area already on another case. But they would arrive shortly after. By 1 p.m, the state police's rolling lab would be here too, complete with hot and cold running forensics experts, and a guy whose job it was to mix up plaster and take moulage casts of the tire prints, Norris had either been smart enough or lucky enough not to run over with the wheels of his own cruiser. Alan opted, rather reluctantly, for lucky. And what would it all come to? Why, just this. A half-drunk old man had stopped to do a favor for a stranger. "Hop on up here, boy," Alan could hear him saying. "I ain't going only a couple of miles, but I'll get you a little further on your way." And the stranger had responded by beating the old man to death and then stealing his truck. He guessed the man in the business suit had asked Homer to pull over,
The most likely pretext would have been to say he needed to take a leak. And once the truck was stopped, he'd clipped the old man, dragged him out, and... Ah, but that was when it got bad. So very goddamn bad.
Alan looked down into the ditch one final time, to where Norris Ridgwick squatted by the bloody piece of meat that had been a man, patiently waving the flies away from what had been Homer's face with his citation clipboard, and felt his stomach turn over again.
He was just an old man, you son of a whore, an old man who was half in the bag and only had one honest arm to boot, an old man whose one little pleasure left was his bowling league night. So why didn't you just clip him that one good one in the cab of his truck and then leave him be? It was a warm night, and even if it had been a little chilly, he most likely would have been okay. I'd bet my watch we're going to find a whole lot of antifreeze in his system. And the truck's license plate number goes out on the wire either way. So why this? Man, I hope I get a chance to ask you.
But did the reason matter? It sure didn't to Homer Gamache. Not anymore. Nothing was ever going to matter to Homer again. Because after clipping him that first one, the hitchhiker had pulled him out of the cab and dragged him into the ditch, probably hauling him by the armpits. Alan didn't need the boys from Capital Crimes to read the marks left by the heels of Gamache's shoes. Along the way, the hitcher had discovered Homer's disability. And at the bottom of the trench, he had wrenched the old man's prosthetic arm from his body and bludgeoned him to death with it.
Chapter 5 96529Q
Hold it, hold it,
Connecticut State Trooper Warren Hamilton said in a loud voice, although he was the only one in the cruiser. It was the evening of June 2nd, some 35 hours after the discovery of Homer Gamache's body in a Maine town Trooper Hamilton had never heard of. He was in the lot of the Westport I-95 McDonald's, southbound. He made it a habit to swing into the lots of the food and gas stops when he was cruising the interstate. If you crawled up the last row of the parking spots at night with your lights off, you sometimes made some good busts. Better than good. Awesome. When he sensed he might have come upon such an opportunity, he very often talked to himself. These soliloquies often started with, hold it, hold it, then progressed to something like, let's check this sucker out, or ask Mama if she believes this. Trooper Hamilton was very big on asking Mama if she believed this when he was on the scent of something juicy. What have we got here? He murmured this time, and reversed the cruiser. Past a Camaro, past a Toyota which looked like a slowly aging horse turd in the beaten copper glare of the arc sodium lights. And, ta-da, an old GMC pickup truck that looked orange in the glare, which meant it was, or had been, white or light gray. He popped his spotlight and trained it on the license plate. License plates, in Trooper Hamilton's humble opinion, were getting better. One by one, the states were putting little pictures on them. This made them easier to identify at night, when varying light conditions transformed actual colors into all sorts of fictional hues. And the worst light of all for plate ID were these goddamn orange high-intensity lamps. He didn't know if they foiled rapes and muggings as they were designed to do, but he was positive they had caused hard-working cops such as himself to bugger plate IDs on stolen cars and fugitive vehicles without number. The little pictures went a long way toward fixing that. A Statue of Liberty was a Statue of Liberty in both bright sunlight and the steady glare of these copper-orange bastards. And no matter what the color, Lady Liberty meant New York. Same as that fucked-up crawdaddy he had the spot trained on right now meant Maine. You didn't have to strain your eyes for vacation land anymore, or try to figure out if what looked pink or orange or electric blue was really white. You just looked for the fucked-up crawdaddy. It was really a lobster, Hamilton knew that, but a fucked-up crawdaddy by any other name was still a fucked-up crawdaddy. And he would have gobbled shit right out of a pig's ass before he put one of those fucking crawdads in his mouth. But he was mighty glad they were there all the same. Especially when he had a want on a crawdaddy license plate, as he did tonight. Ask Mama if she believes this, he murmured, and put the cruiser in park. He took his clipboard from the magnetized strip, which held it to the center of the dash, just above the drive shaft hump, flipped past the blank citation form all cops kept as a shield over the hot sheet,
No need for the general public to be gawking at the license plate numbers the cops were particularly interested in, while the cop to whom the sheet belonged was grabbing a hamburger or taking an express dump at a handy filling station, and ran his thumbnail down the list. And here it was. 96529Q, State of Maine, home of the fucked-up crawdaddies. Trooper Hamilton's initial pass had shown him no one was in the cab of the truck. There was a rifle rack, but it was empty. It was possible, not likely, but possible, that there might be someone in the bed of the truck. It was even possible that the someone in the bed of the truck might have the rifle which belonged in the rack. More likely, the driver was either long gone or grabbing a burger inside. All the same, old cops, bold cops, but no old bold cops, Trooper Hamilton said in a low voice. He snapped off the spot and slowly cruised on down the line of cars. He paused twice more, snapping the spot on both times, although he didn't even bother to look at the cars he was lighting up. There was always the possibility that Mr. 96529Q had seen Hamilton spotlighting the stolen truck while on his way back from the restaurant Cum Dumpatorium, and if he saw the trooper car had passed on up the line and was checking other cars, he might not take off. Safe is safe, sorry is sorry, and that's all I know, by the great Bigori, Trooper Hamilton exclaimed. This was another of his favorites, not quite up there with asking Mama if she believed this, but close. He pulled into a slot where he could observe the pickup. He called his base, which was less than 4 miles up the road, and told them he had found the GMC pickup Maine wanted in a murder case. He requested backup units and was told they would arrive shortly. Hamilton observed no one approaching the pickup and decided it would not be overbold to approach the vehicle with caution. In fact, he would look like a wimp if he was still sitting here in the dark, one row over, when the other units arrived. He got out of his cruiser, thumbing the strap off his gun, but not unholstering it. He had unholstered his piece only twice while on duty and fired it not at all. Nor did he want to do either one now. He approached the pickup at an angle that allowed him to observe both the truck, especially the bed of the truck, and the approach from Mickey D's. He paused as a man and woman walked from the restaurant to a Ford sedan 3 rows closer to the restaurant, then moved on when they got in their car and headed for the exit. Keeping his right hand on the butt of his service revolver, Hamilton dropped his left hand to his hip. Service belts, in Hamilton's humble opinion, were also getting better. He had, both as man and boy, been a huge fan of Batman, a.k.a. the Caped Crusader. He suspected, in fact, that the Batman was one of the reasons he had become a cop. This was a little factoid he hadn't bothered to put on his application. His favorite Batman accessory had not been the Bat-Pole or the Batarang, not even the Batmobile itself, but the Caped Crusader's utility belt. That wonderful item of apparel was like a good gift shop. It had a little something for all occasions, be it a rope, a pair of night vision goggles, or a few capsules of stun gas. His service belt was nowhere near as good, but on the left side there were 3 loops holding 3 very useful items. One was a battery-powered cylinder marketed under the name Downhound. When you pressed the red button on top, Downhound emitted an ultrasonic whistle that turned even raging pit bulls into bowls of limp spaghetti. Next to it was a pressure can of mace, the Connecticut State Police version of Batman's stun gas, and next to the mace was a 4-cell flashlight. Hamilton pulled the flashlight from its loop, turned it on, then slid his left hand up to partially hood the beam. He did this without once removing his right hand from the butt of his revolver. Old cops, bold cops, no old bold cops. He ran the beam along the bed of the pickup truck. There was a scrap of tarpaulin in there, but nothing else. The truck bed was as empty as the cab. Hamilton had remained a prudent distance away from the GMC with the crawdaddy plates all the while. This was so ingrained he hadn't even thought about it. Now he bent and shone the flashlight beneath the truck, the last place where someone who meant him harm might be lurking. Unlikely, but when he finally kicked off, he didn't want the minister to begin his eulogy by saying, "Dear friends, we are here today to mourn the unlikely passing of Trooper Warren Hamilton." That would be Trey tacky. He swept the beam quickly left to right under the truck and observed nothing but a rusty muffler which was going to drop off in the near future. Not from the look of the holes in it,
that the driver would notice much difference when it did. "I think we're alone, dear," Trooper Hamilton said. He examined the area surrounding the truck one final time, paying particular attention to the approach from the restaurant. He observed no one observing him, and so he stepped up to the passenger window of the cab and shone his light inside. "Holy shit," Hamilton murmured. "Ask Mama if she believes this happy crappy." He was suddenly very glad for the orange lamps which sent their glare across the parking lot and into the cab, because they turned what he knew was maroon to a color which was almost black, making the blood look more like ink.
"He drove it like that? Jesus Christ, all the way from Maine, he drove it like that? Ask Mama."
He tipped his flashlight downward. The seat and the floor of the GMC was a sty. He saw beer cans, soft drink cans, empty or near-empty potato chip and pork rind bags, boxes which had contained Big Macs and Whoppers. A wad of what looked like bubble gum was squashed onto the metal dashboard above the hole where there had once been a radio. There were a number of unfiltered cigarette butts in the ashtray. Most of all, there was blood. There were streaks and blotches of blood on the seat. Blood was grimed into the steering wheel. There was a dried splatter of blood on the horn ring, almost entirely obscuring the Chevrolet symbol embossed there. There was blood on the driver's inside door handle and blood on the mirror. That spot was a small circle that wanted to be an oval, and Hamilton thought that Mr. 96529Q might have left an almost perfect thumbprint in his victim's blood when he adjusted his rear view. There was also a large splatter of gore on one of the Big Mac boxes. That one looked like there might be some hair stuck in it.
"What did he tell the drive-up girl?" Hamilton muttered. "He cut himself shaving?"
There was a scraping noise behind him. Hamilton whirled, feeling too slow, feeling all too sure that he had, despite his routine precautions, been too bold to ever get old. Because there was nothing routine about this. No, sir. The guy had gotten behind him, and soon there would be more blood in the cab of the old Chevrolet pickup. His blood. Because a guy who would drive a portable abattoir like this from Maine almost to the New York state line was a psycho, the sort of guy who would kill a state trooper with no more thought than he'd take to buy a quart of milk. Hamilton drew his revolver for the third time in his career, thumbed the hammer back, and almost triggered a shot, or two, or three, into nothing but darkness. He was wired to the max, but there was no one there. He lowered the gun by slow degrees, blood thumping in his temples. A little gust of wind puffed the night. The scraping noise came again. On the pavement he saw a Filet-O-Fish box, from this very McDonald's, no doubt. "How clever you are, Holmes. Do not mention it, Watson. It was really elementary. Skitter 5 or 6 feet at the whim of the breeze and then come to rest again." Hamilton let out a long, shaky breath and carefully dropped the hammer on his revolver.
"Almost embarrassed yourself there, Holmes," he said in a voice that was not at all steady. "Almost stuck yourself with a CR-14.
A CR-14 was a fired form. He thought about holstering his gun again, now that it was clear there was nothing to shoot but an empty fish sandwich box, and then decided he would just hold onto it until he saw the other units arriving. It felt good in his hand. Comforting. Because it wasn't just the blood or the fact that the man some Maine cop wanted for murder had driven 400 miles or so in that mess. There was a stench around the truck, which was in a way like the stench around the spot in some country road where a car has hit and crushed a skunk. He didn't know if the arriving officers would pick it up or if it was just for him, and he didn't much care. It wasn't a smell of blood or rotten food or B.O. It was, he thought, just the smell of bad. Something very, very bad. Bad enough so that he didn't want to holster his revolver, even though he was almost positive that the owner of that smell was gone, probably hours ago. He heard none of the ticking noises which came from an engine that was still warm. It didn't matter. It didn't change what he knew. For a while, the truck had been the den of some terrible animal, and he wasn't going to take the slightest risk that the animal might return and find him unprepared. And Mama could make book on that. He stood there, gun in hand, hairs on the back of his neck prickling, and it seemed a very long time before the backup units finally came. Chapter 6 Death in the Big City. Doty Eberhardt was pissed off, and when Doty Eberhardt was pissed off, there was one broad in the nation's capital you didn't want to fuck with.
She climbed the stairs of the L Street apartment building with the stolidity, and nearly the bulk, of a rhino crossing an open stretch of grassland. Her navy blue dress stretched and relaxed over a bosom which was rather too large to simply be called ample. Her meaty arms swung like pendulums. A good many years ago, this woman had been one of Washington's most stunning call girls. In those days, her height, 6'3", as well as her good looks, had made her more than just a naughty bit of fluff. She was so sought after that a night with her was almost as good as a trophy in a sporting gentleman's den. And if one were to carefully review the photographs of various Washington fêtes and soirées taken during the second Johnson administration and the first Nixon administration, one might spot Dodie Eberhardt in many of them, usually on the arm of a man whose name appeared frequently in weighty political articles and essays. Her height alone made her hard to miss. Dodie was a whore with the heart of a bank teller and the soul of an acquisitive cockroach. Two of her regular Johns, one a Democratic senator and the other a Republican representative with a good deal of seniority, had provided her with enough cash to retire from the business. They had not exactly done this of their own volition. Dodie was aware that the risk of disease was not exactly decreasing, and highly placed government officials are as vulnerable to AIDS and various lesser, but still troubling, venereal diseases as the commoners. Her age wasn't decreasing either, nor did she completely trust these gentlemen to leave her something in their wills, as both had promised to do. "I'm sorry," she'd told them, "but I don't believe in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy anymore either, you see. Little Dodie is all on her own." Little Dodie purchased 3 apartment houses with the money. Years passed. The 170 pounds which had brought strong men to their knees, usually in front of her as she stood nude before them, had now become 280. Investments which had done well in the mid-70s had soured in the 80s, when it seemed everyone else in the country with money in the stock market was getting well. She'd had 2 excellent brokers on her short list right up until the end of the active phase of her career. There were times she wished she'd held on to them when she retired. One apartment house had gone in 84, the second in 86, following a disastrous IRS audit. She had held onto this one on L Street as grimly as a losing player in a cutthroat game of Monopoly, convinced that it was in a neighborhood which was about to happen. But it hadn't happened yet, and she didn't think it would happen for another year or two, if then. When it did, she meant to pack her bags and move to Aruba. In the meantime, the landlady, who had once been the capital city's most sought-after fuck, would just have to hang on. Which she always had. Which she intended to keep on doing. And God help anyone who got in her way. Like Frederick, Mr. Big Shot, Clausen, for instance. She reached the second floor landing. Guns N' Roses was bellowing out of the Schulman's apartment. "Turn that fucking record player down," she yelled at the top of her lungs. And when Dodie Eberhardt raised her voice to its maximum decibel level, windows cracked, the eardrums of small children ruptured, and dogs fell dead. The music went from a scream to a whisper at once. She could sense the Schulmans quivering against each other like a pair of scared puppies in a thunderstorm, and praying it was not them the Wicked Witch of L Street had come to see. They were afraid of her. That was not an unwise way to feel. Schulman was a corporate lawyer with a high-powered firm, but he was still 2 ulcers away from being high-powered enough to give Dodie pause. If he should cross her at this stage of his young life, she would wear his guts for garters, and he knew it, and that was very satisfactory. When the bottom dropped out of both your bank accounts and your investment portfolio, you had to take your satisfactions where you found them. Dodie turned the corner without breaking stride and started up the stairs to the 3rd floor, where Frederick, Mr. Big Shot, Clausen lived in solitary splendor. She walked with that same even rhino crossing the veldt stride, head up, not in the least out of breath in spite of her poundage, the staircase shaking the tiniest bit in spite of its solidity. She was looking forward to this. Clausen wasn't even on the low rung of a corporate law ladder. As of now, he wasn't on the ladder at all. Like all the law students she had ever met, mostly as tenants, she had certainly never fucked any in what she now thought of as her other life, he was composed chiefly of high aspirations and low funds, both of them floating on a generous cushion of bullshit. Dodie did not, as a rule, confuse any of these elements. Falling for a law student's line of bull was, in her mind, as bad as turning a trick for free.
Once you started in with behavior like that, you might as well hang up your jock. Figuratively speaking, of course. Yet Frederick, Mr. Bigshot, Clausen, had partially breached her defenses. He had been late with the rent 4 times in a row, and she had allowed this because he had convinced her that in his case, the tired old scripture was really the truth, or might come to be. He did have money coming in. He could not have done this to her if he had claimed Sidney Sheldon was really Robert Ludlum, or Victoria Holt was really Rosemary Rogers, because she didn't give a shit about those people or their billions of write-alikes. She was into crime novels, and if they were really gut-bucket crime novels, so much the better. She supposed there were plenty of people out there who went for the romantic slop and the spy shit, if the post-Sunday bestseller list was any indication. But she had been reading Elmore Leonard for years before he hit the lists, and she had also formed strong attachments for Jim Thompson, David Goodis, Horace McCoy, Charles Wilford, and the rest of those guys. If you wanted it short and sweet, Dodie Eberhardt liked novels where men robbed banks, shot each other, and demonstrated how much they loved their women mostly by beating the shit out of them. George Stark, in her opinion, was, or had been, the best of them. She had been a dedicated fan from Machine's Way and Oxford Blues right up to Riding to Babylon, which looked to be the last of them. The big shot in the third-floor apartment had been surrounded by notes and Stark novels the first time she came to dun him about the rent. Only 3 days overdue that time, but of course if you gave them an inch, they took a mile. And after she had taken care of her business and he had promised to deliver a check to her by noon the following day, she asked him if the collected works of George Stark were now required reading for a career before the bar. No, Clausen had said with a bright, cheerful, and utterly predatory smile. But they might just finance one. It was the smile more than anything else which had hooked her and caused her to pay out line in his case where she had snubbed it brutally tight in all others. She had seen that smile many times before in her own mirror. She had believed then that such a smile could not be faked, and, just for the record, she still believed it. Clausen really had the goods on Thaddeus Beaumont. His mistake had been believing so confidently that Beaumont would go along with the plans of a Mr. Big Shot like Frederick Clausen. And it had been her mistake, too. She had read one of the 2 Beaumont novels, Purple Haze, following Clausen's explanation of what he had discovered, and thought it an exquisitely stupid book. In spite of the correspondence and photocopies Mr. Big Shot had shown her, she would have found it difficult or impossible to believe both writers were the same man. Except, about 3/4 of the way through it, at a point where she had been about ready to throw the boring piece of shit across the room and forget the whole thing, there was a scene in which a farmer shot a horse. The horse had 2 broken legs and needed to be shot. But the thing was, old Farmer John had enjoyed it. Had, in fact, put the barrel of the gun against the horse's head and then jerked himself off, squeezing the trigger at the moment of climax. It was, she thought, as if Beaumont had stepped out to get a cup of coffee when he got to that part, and George Stark had stepped in and written the scene, like a literary Rumpelstiltskin. Certainly it was the only gold in that particular pile of hay. Well, none of it mattered now. All it proved was that no one was immune to bullshit forever. The big shot had taken her for a ride, but at least it had been a short ride, and it was now over. Dodie Eberhardt reached the 3rd-floor landing, her hand already curling into the sort of tight fist she made when the time had come not for polite knocking, but hammering. And then she saw hammering would not be necessary. The big shot's door was standing ajar. "Jesus wept," Dodie muttered, her lip curling. This wasn't a junky neighborhood, but when it came to ripping off some idiot's apartment, the junkies were more than willing to cross boundary lines. The guy was even stupider than she had thought. She rapped on the door with her knuckles, and it swung open. "Clausen," she called in a voice which promised doom and damnation. There was no answer. Looking up the short corridor, she could see the shades in the living room were drawn and the overhead light was burning. A radio was playing softly. "Clausen, I want to talk to you." She started up the short corridor and stopped. One of the sofa cushions was on the floor. That was all. No sign that the place had been trashed by a hungry junkie, but her instincts were still sharp, and her wind was up in a moment. She smelled something. It was very faint, but it was there. A little like food which had spoiled, but not yet rotted. That wasn't it.
but it was as close as she could come. Had she smelled it before? She thought she had. And there was another smell, although she didn't think it was her nose which was making her aware of it. She knew that one right away. She and Trooper Hamilton from Connecticut would have agreed at once on what it was. The smell of bad. She stood just outside the living room, looking at the tumbled cushion, listening to the radio. What the climb up 3 flights of stairs hadn't been able to do, that one innocent cushion had. Her heart was beating rapidly under her massive left breast, and her breath was coming shallowly through her mouth. Something was not right here. Very much not right. The question was whether or not she would become a part of it if she hung around. Common sense told her to go, go while she still had a chance, and common sense was very strong. Curiosity told her to stay and peek, and it was stronger. She edged her head around the entrance to the living room and looked first to her right, where there was a fake fireplace, 2 windows giving a view on L Street, and not much else. She looked to the left, and her head suddenly stopped moving. It actually seemed to lock in position. Her eyes widened. That locked stare lasted no more than 3 seconds, but it seemed much longer to her. And she saw everything, down to the smallest detail. Her mind made its own photograph of what it was seeing, as clear and sharp as those the crime photographer would soon take. She saw the 2 bottles of Amstel beer on the coffee table, one empty and the other half full, with a collar of foam still inside the bottleneck. She saw the ashtray with Chicagoland written on its curving surface. She saw 2 cigarette butts, unfiltered, squashed into the center of the tray's pristine whiteness, although the big shot didn't smoke. Not cigarettes, at least. She saw the small plastic box, which had once been full of pushpins, lying on its side between the bottles and the ashtray. Most of the pushpins, which the big shot used to tack things to his kitchen bulletin board, were scattered across the glass surface of the coffee table. She saw a few had come to rest on an open copy of People magazine, the one featuring the Thad Beaumont George Stark story. She could see Mr. and Mrs. Beaumont shaking hands across Stark's gravestone, although from here they were upside down. It was the story that, according to Frederick Clausen, would never be printed. It was going to make him a moderately wealthy man instead. He had been wrong about that. In fact, it seemed he had been wrong about everything. She could see Frederick Clausen, who had gone from Mr. Big Shot to no shot at all, sitting in one of his 2 living room chairs. He had been tied in. He was naked, his clothes thrown into a snarly ball under the coffee table. She saw the bloody hole at his groin. His testicles were still where they belonged. His penis had been stuffed into his mouth. There was plenty of room because the murderer had also cut out Mr. Big Shot's tongue. It was tacked to the wall. The pushpin had been driven into its pink meat so deeply that she could only see a grinning crescent of bright yellow, which was the pushpin's top, and her mind relentlessly photographed this, too. Blood had drizzled down the wallpaper below it, making a wavery fan shape. The killer had employed another pushpin, this one with a bright green head, to nail the 2nd page of the People magazine article to the ex-Big Shot's bare chest. She could not see Liz Beaumont's face, it was obscured by Clausen's blood, but she could see the woman's hand holding out the pan of brownies for Thad's smiling inspection. She remembered that picture in particular had irked Clausen. "What a put-up job," he had exclaimed. "She hates to cook. She said so in an interview just after Beaumont published his 1st novel. Finger written in blood above the severed tongue tacked to the wall were these 5 words. "The sparrows are flying again." "Jesus Christ," some distant part of her mind thought. "It's just like a George Stark novel, like something Alexis Machine would do." From behind her came a soft bumping sound. Dobie Eberhardt screamed and whirled. Machine came at her with his terrible straight razor, its steely glitter now sleeved with Frederick Clausen's blood. His face was the twisted mask of scars, which was all Noni Griffiths had left after she had carved him up at the end of Machine's way. And there was no one there at all. The door had swung shut, that was all, the way doors sometimes do. "Is that so?" the distant part of her mind asked. Except it was closer now, raising its voice, urgent with fright. "It was standing partway open with no problem at all when you came up the stairs. Not wide open, but enough so you could tell it wasn't shut." Now her eyes went back to the beer bottles on the coffee table, one empty, one half full with a ring of foam still on the inside of the neck. The killer had been behind the door when she came in. If she had turned her head, she would almost surely have seen him. and now she would be dead, too. And while she had been standing here, mesmerized by the colorful remains of Frederick, Mr. Big Shot Clausen, he had simply gone out, closing the door behind him. The strength flowed out of her legs, and she slipped to her knees with a weird kind of grace, looking like a girl about to take communion. Her mind ran frantically over the same thought, like a gerbil on an exercise wheel. Oh, I shouldn't have screamed. He'll come back. Oh, I shouldn't have screamed. He'll come back. Oh, I shouldn't have screamed. And then she heard him, the measured thud of his big feet on the hall carpet. Later she became convinced that the goddamn Shulmans had turned up their stereo again, and she had mistaken the steady thump of the bass for footsteps. But at that moment she was convinced it was Alexis' machine and he was returning. A man so dedicated and so murderous that not even death would stop him. For the first time in her life, Dodie Eberhardt fainted. She came to less than 3 minutes later. Her legs would still not support her, so she crawled back down the short apartment hallway to the door with her hair hanging in her face. She thought of opening the door and looking out, but could not bring herself to do it. She turned the thumb lock instead, then shot the bolt and clicked the police bar into its steel foot. Those things done, she sat against the door, gasping, the world a gray blur. She was vaguely aware that she had locked herself in with a mutilated corpse, but that wasn't so bad. It wasn't bad at all when you consider the alternatives. Little by little, her strength came back, and she was able to get to her feet. She slipped around the corner at the end of the hall and then into the kitchen, where the phone was. She kept her eyes averted from what remained of Mr. Big Shot, although it was an empty exercise. She would see that mind photograph in all its hideous clarity for a long time to come. She called the police, and when they came, she wouldn't let them in until one of them slid his ID under the door. "What's your wife's name?" she asked the cop, whose laminated badge identified him as Charles F. Toomey, Jr. Her voice was high and quiverly, utterly unlike her usual one. Close friends, had she had any, would not have recognized it. "Stephanie, ma'am," the voice on the other side of the door replied patiently. "I can call your station house and check that, you know," she nearly shrieked. "I know you can, Mrs. Eberhardt," the voice responded. "But you'd feel safer quicker if you just let us in, don't you think?" And because she still recognized the voice of cop as easily as she had recognized the smell of bad, she unlocked the door and let Toomey and his partner in. Once they were, Dodie did something else she had never done before. She went into hysterics. Chapter 7. Police Business. 1. Thad was upstairs in his study, writing, when the police came. Liz was reading a book in the living room while William and Wendy goofed with each other in the oversized playpen they shared. She went to the door, looking out through one of the narrow ornamental windows which flanked it before opening it. This was a habit she had gotten into since what was jokingly called Thad's debut in People magazine. Visitors, vague acquaintances for the most part, with a generous mixture of curious town residents and even a few total strangers, these latter unanimously Stark fans, thrown in for good measure, had taken to dropping by. Thad called it the see-the-living-crocodile syndrome and said it would peter out in another week or two. Liz hoped he was right. In the meantime, she worried that one of the new callers might be a mad crocodile hunter of the sort who had killed John Lennon and peeked through the side window first. She didn't know if she would recognize a bona fide madman if she saw one, but she could at least keep Thad's train of thought from derailing during the 2 hours each morning he spent writing. After that, he went to the door himself, usually throwing her a guilty little boy look to which she didn't know how to respond. The three men on the front doorstep this Saturday morning were not fans of either Beaumont or Stark, she guessed, and not madmen either, unless some of the current crop had taken to driving state police cruisers. She opened the door, feeling the uneasy twinge even the most blameless people must feel when the police show up without being called. She supposed if she'd had children old enough to be out whooping and hollering this rainy Saturday morning, she would already be wondering if they were okay.
"Yes?"
"Are you Mrs. Elizabeth Beaumont?" one of them asked.
"Yes, I am. May I help you?"
"Is your husband home, Mrs. Beaumont?" a second asked. These two were wearing identical gray rain slickers and state police hats.
"No, that's the ghost of Ernest Hemingway you hear clacking away upstairs," she thought of saying, and of course didn't.
First came the "has anybody had an accident fright," then the phantom guilt which made you want to come out with something harsh or sarcastic, something which said,
no matter what the actual words.
Go away. You are not wanted here. We have done nothing wrong. Go and find someone who has.
May I ask why you'd like to see him?
The third policeman was Alan Pangborn.
Police business, Mrs. Beaumont, he said. Maybe speak with him, please.
2. Thad Beaumont did not keep anything resembling an organized journal, but he did sometimes write about the events in his own life which interested, amused, or frightened him. He kept these accounts in a bound ledger, and his wife did not care much for them. They gave her the creeps, in fact, although she had never told Thad so. Most were strangely passionless, almost as if a part of him was standing aside and reporting on his life with its own divorced and almost disinterested eye. Following the visit of the police on the morning of June 4th, he wrote a long entry with a strong and unusual subcurrent of emotion running through it.
I understand Kafka's The Trial and Orwell's 1984 a little better now, Thad wrote. To read them as political novels and no more is a serious mistake. I suppose the depression I went through after finishing Dancers and discovering there was nothing waiting behind it, except for Liz's miscarriage, that is, still counts as the most wrenching emotional experience of our married life. But what happened today seems worse. I tell myself it's because the experience is still fresh, but I suspect it's a lot more than that. I suppose if my time in the darkness and the loss of those first twins are wounds which have healed, leaving only scars to mark the places where they were, then this new wound will also heal. But I don't believe time will ever gloss it over completely. It will also leave its scar, one which is shorter, but deeper, like the fading tattoo of a sudden knife slash. I'm sure the police behaved according to their oaths, if they still take them, and I guess they do. Yet there was then, and still is now, a feeling that I was in danger of being pulled into some faceless bureaucratic machine. Not men, but a machine which would go methodically on about its business until it had chewed me to rags. Because chewing people to rags is the machine's business. The sound of my screams would neither hurry nor delay that machine's chewing action. I could tell Liz was nervous when she came upstairs and told me the police wanted to see me about something but wouldn't tell her what it was. She said one of them was Alan Pangborn, the Castle County Sheriff. I may have met him once or twice before, but I only really recognized him because his picture is in the Castle Rock Call from time to time. I was curious and grateful for a break from the typewriter, where my people have been insisting on doing things I don't want them to do for the last week. If I thought anything, I suppose I thought it might have something to do with Frederick Clausen or some bit of fallout from the People article. I don't know if I can get the tone of the meeting which followed right or not. I don't know if it even matters, only that it seems important to try. They were standing in the hall near the foot of the stairs, three large men. It's no wonder people call them bulls. Dripping a little water onto the carpet.
Are you Thaddeus Beaumont?
One of them, it was Sheriff Pangborn, asked, and that's when the emotional change I want to describe, or at least indicate, began to happen. Puzzlement joined the curiosity and pleasure at being released, however briefly, from the typewriter. And a little worry. My full name, but no mister, like a judge addressing a defendant upon whom he is about to pass sentence.
Yes, that's right, I said. And you're Sheriff Pangborn. I know because we've got a place on Castle Lake.
Then I put out my hand, that old automatic gesture of the well-trained American male.
He just looked at it, and an expression came over his face. It was as if he'd opened the door of his refrigerator and discovered the fish he'd bought for supper had spoiled.
I have no intention of shaking your hand, he said, so you might as well put it back down again and save us both some embarrassment.
It was a hell of a strange thing to say, a downright rude thing to say, but that didn't bother me as much as the way he said it. It was as if he thought I was out of my mind. And just like that, I was terrified. Even now I find it difficult to believe how rapidly, how goddamn rapidly, my emotions lensed through the spectrum from ordinary curiosity and some pleasure at the break in an accustomed routine to naked fear. In that instant, I knew they weren't here just to talk to me about something because they believed I had done something. And in that first moment of horror,
I have no intention of shaking your hand. I was sure that I had.
That's what I need to express. In the moment of dead silence that followed Pangborn's refusal to shake my hand, I thought, in fact, that I had done everything and would be powerless not to confess my guilt. 3. Thad lowered his hand slowly. From the corner of his eye, he could see Liz with her hands clasped into a tight white ball between her breasts, and suddenly he wanted to be furious at this cop, who had been invited freely into his home and had then refused to shake his hand. This cop, whose salary was paid, at least in some small part, by the taxes the Beaumonts paid on their house in Castle Rock. This cop who had frightened Liz. This cop who had frightened him.
"Very well," Thad said evenly. "If you won't shake hands with me, then perhaps you'll tell me why you're here."
Unlike the state cops, Alan Pangborn was wearing not a rain slicker, but a waterproof jacket which came only to his waist. He reached into his back pocket, brought out a card, and began to read from it. It took Thad a moment to realize he was hearing a variation of the Miranda warning.
"As you said, my name is Alan Pangborn, Mr. Beaumont. I am the sheriff of Castle County, Maine. I'm here because I have to question you in connection with a capital crime. I will ask you these questions at the Orono State Police Barracks. You have the right to remain silent."
"Oh, dear Jesus, please, what is this?" Liz asked, and layered on top of that, Thad heard himself saying, "Wait a minute, wait just a damn minute." He intended to roar this, but even with his brain telling his lungs to turn the volume up to a full lecture hall quieting bellow, the best he could manage was a mild objection that Pangborn overrode easily.
"And you have the right to legal counsel. If you cannot afford legal counsel, such will be provided for you."
He replaced the card in his back pocket.
"Thad?"
Liz was crowding against him like a small child frightened by thunder. Her huge puzzled eyes stared at Pangborn. Every so often they flicked to the state troopers who looked big enough to play defense on a pro football team, but mostly they remained on Pangborn.
"I'm not going anywhere with you," Thad said.
His voice was shaking, jigging up and down, changing registers like the voice of a young adolescent. He was still trying to be furious.
"I don't believe you can compel me to do that."
One of the troopers cleared his throat. "The alternative," he said, "is for us to go back and get a warrant for your arrest, Mr. Beaumont. On the basis of information in our possession, that would be very easy." The trooper glanced at Pangborn.
"It might be fair to add that Sheriff Pangborn wanted us to bring one with us. He argued very strongly for it, and I guess he would have gotten his way if you weren't something of a public figure."
Pangborn looked disgusted, possibly by this fact, possibly because the trooper was informing Thad of the fact, most likely both. The trooper saw the look, shuffled his wet shoes as if a trifle embarrassed, but pushed on anyway. "With the situation being what it is, I have no problem with you knowing that." He looked questioningly at his partner, who nodded. Pangborn just went on looking disgusted and angry.
"He looks," Thad thought, "as if he'd like to rip me open with his fingernails and wrap my guts around my head."
"That sounds very professional," Thad said. He was relieved to find he was getting at least some of his wind back and his voice was settling down. He wanted to be angry because anger would allay the fear, but he could still manage no more than bewilderment. He felt sucker-punched.
"What it ignores is the fact that I don't have the slightest idea what this goddamn situation is." "If we believe that to be the case, we wouldn't be here, Mr. Beaumont," Pangborn said.
The expression of loathing on his face finally turned the trick. Thad was suddenly infuriated.
"I don't care what you think," Thad said. "I told you that I know who you are, Sheriff Pangborn. My wife and I have owned a summer house in Castle Rock since 1973, long before you ever heard of the place. I don't know what you're doing here, 160-odd miles from your territory, or why you're looking at me like I was a splat of bird shit on a new car. But I can tell you I'm not going anywhere with you until I find out. If it's going to take an arrest warrant, you go on and get one. But I want you to know that if you do, you're going to be up to your neck in a kettle of boiling shit, and I'll be the one underneath stoking the fire. Because I haven't done anything. This is fucking outrageous. Just fucking outrageous."
Now his voice had reached full volume, and both the troopers looked a little abashed. Pangborn did not. He went on staring at Thad in that unsettling way. In the other room, one of the twins began to cry. Oh, Jesus, Liz moaned. What is this? Tell us.
Go take care of the kids, babe, Thad said, not unlocking his gaze from Pangborn's.
But...
Please, he said. And then both babies were crying. This will be all right. She gave him a final trembling look, her eyes saying, Do you promise? And then went into the living room.
We want to question you in connection with the murder of Homer Gamache, the second trooper said.
Thad broke his hard stare at Pangborn and turned to the trooper.
Who?
Homer Gamache, Pangborn repeated. Are you going to tell us the name means nothing to you, Mr. Beaumont?
Of course I'm not, Thad said, astonished. Homer takes our trash to the dump when we're in town, makes some small repairs around the house. He lost an arm in Korea. They gave him the Silver Star.
Bronze, Pangborn said stonily.
Homer's dead? Who killed him?
The troopers now looked at each other, surprised. After grief, astonishment may be the most difficult human emotion to fake effectively. The first trooper replied in a curiously gentle voice,
We have every reason to believe you did, Mr. Beaumont. That's why we're here.
4. Thad looked at him with utter blankness for a moment and then laughed.
Jesus! Jesus Christ, this is crazy!
Do you want to get a coat, Mr. Beaumont? The other trooper asked.
Raining pretty hard out there.
I'm not going anywhere with you,
he repeated absently, entirely missing Pangborn's sudden expression of exasperation.
Thad was thinking. I'm afraid you are, Pangborn said, one way or the other.
It'll have to be the other, then, he said, and then came out of himself.
When did this happen?
Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said, speaking slowly and enunciating carefully. It was as if he were speaking to a 4-year-old, and not a terribly bright one at that. We're not here to give you information.
Liz came back into the doorway with the babies. All color had drained from her face. Her forehead shone like a lamp.
This is crazy, she said,
looking from Pangborn to the troopers, and then back to Pangborn again.
Crazy. Don't you know that?
Listen, Thad said, walking over to Liz and putting an arm around her. I didn't kill Homer, Sheriff Pangborn, but I understand now why you're so pissed. Come on upstairs to my office. Let's sit down and see if we can't figure this out.
I want you to get your coat, Pangborn said.
He glanced at Liz.
Forgive my French, but I've had about all the bullshit I can put up with for a rainy Saturday morning. We have you cold.
Thad looked at the older of the two state troopers.
Can you talk some sense to this man? Tell him that he can avoid a whole lot of embarrassment and trouble just by telling me when Homer was killed?
And, as an afterthought, and where? If it was in the rock, I can't imagine what Homer would be doing up here. Well, I haven't been out of Ludlow except to go to the university in the last 2.5 months. He looked at Liz, who nodded. The trooper thought it over and then said,
Excuse us a moment.
The three of them went back down the hallway, the troopers almost appearing to lead Pangborn. They went out the front door. As soon as it was shut, Liz burst into a spate of confused questions. Thad knew her well enough to suspect her terror would have come out as anger, fury even, at the cops, if not for the news of Homer Gamache's death. As things were, she was on the edge of tears.
It's going to be all right, he said, and kissed her on the cheek.
As an afterthought, he also bussed William and Wendy, who were beginning to look decidedly troubled.
I think the state troopers already know I'm telling the truth. Pangborn, well, he knew Homer. You did, too. He's just pissed as hell. And from the look and sound of him, he must have what seems like unshakable evidence tying me to the murder, he thought, but did not add.
He walked down the hall and peered out the narrow side window as Liz had done. If not for the situation, what he saw would have been funny. The three of them were standing on the stoop, almost but not quite out of the rain, having a conference. Thad could get the sound of their voices, but not the sense. He thought they looked like ball players conferring on the mound during a late-inning rally by the other team. Both state cops were talking to Pangborn, who was shaking his head and replying heatedly. Thad went back down the hall.
What are they doing? Liz asked.
I don't know, Thad said, but I think the state cops are trying to talk Pangborn into telling me why he's so sure I killed Homer Gamache. Or at least some of the why.
Poor Homer, she muttered. This is like a bad dream. He took William from her and told her again not to worry.
5.
The policeman came in about 2 minutes later. Pangborn's face was a thundercloud. Thad surmised the two state cops had told him what Pangborn himself already knew but didn't want to admit. The writer was exhibiting none of the ticks and twitches they associated with guilt.
All right, Pangborn said.
He was trying to avoid surliness, Thad thought, and doing a pretty good job. Not quite succeeding, but doing a pretty good job all the same, considering he was in the presence of his number one suspect in the murder of a one-armed old man.
These gentlemen would like me to ask you at least one question here, Mr. Beaumont, and so I will. Can you account for your whereabouts during the time period from 11 p.m. on May 31st until 4 a.m. on June 1st?
The Beaumonts exchanged a glance. Thad felt a great weight around his heart loosen. It did not quite fall off, not yet, but he felt as if all the catches holding that weight had been unbuckled. Now all it would take was one good push.
Was it? He murmured to his wife.
He thought it was, but it seemed just a little too good to be true.
I'm sure it was, Liz responded.
The 31st, did you say?
She was looking at Pangborn with radiant hope. Pangborn looked back suspiciously.
Yes, ma'am, but I'm afraid your unsubstantiated word won't be.
She was ignoring him, counting backward on her fingers. Suddenly she grinned like a schoolgirl.
Tuesday. Tuesday was the 31st, she cried to her husband. It was. Thank God.
Pangborn looked puzzled and more suspicious than ever. The troopers looked at each other and then looked back at Liz.
You want to let us in on it, Mrs. Beaumont? One asked.
We had a party here the night of Tuesday the 31st, she replied, and flashed Pangborn a look of triumph and vicious dislike. We had a houseful, didn't we, Thad?
We sure did. In a case like this, a good alibi itself is cause for suspicion, Pangborn said, but he looked off balance.
Oh, you silly, arrogant man, Liz exclaimed. Bright color now flamed in her cheeks. Fear was passing, fury was arriving.
She looked at the troopers.
If my husband doesn't have an alibi for this murder you say he committed, you take him to the police station. If he does, this man says it probably means he did it anyway. What are you, afraid of a little honest work? Why are you here?
Quit now, Liz, Thad said quietly. They've got good reasons for being here. If Sheriff Pangborn were on a wild goose chase or running on hunch, I believe he would come alone.
Pangborn gave him a sour look, then sighed.
Tell us about this party, Mr. Beaumont.
It was for Tom Carroll, Thad said. Tom has been in the university English department for 19 years, and he's been chairman for the last 5. He retired on May 27th, when the academic year officially ended. He's always been a great favorite in the department, known to most of us old warhorses as Gonzo Tom because of his great liking for Hunter Thompson's essays. So we decided to throw a retirement party for him and his wife.
What time did this party end?
Thad grinned. Well, it was over before 4 in the morning, but it ran late. When you put a bunch of English teachers together with an almost unlimited supply of booze, you could burn down a weekend. Guests started arriving around 8, and...
Who was last, honey?
Raleigh de Lesseps and that awful woman from the history department he's been going out with since Jesus was a baby, she said. The one who goes around blaring, "Just call me Billy, everyone does."
Right.
Thad said. He was grinning now. The Wicked Witch of the East. Pangborn's eyes were sending a clear, "You're lying, and we both know it" message.
And what time did these friends leave?
Thad shuddered a little. Friends? Raleigh, yes. That woman, most definitely not.
2 o'clock, Liz said.
Thad nodded. It had to have been at least 2 when we saw them out. Damn near poured them out. As I indicated, it will be a snowy day in hell before I'm inducted into the Wilhelmina Burks fan club. But I would have insisted they stay over if he'd had more than 3 miles to drive, or if it had been earlier. No one on the roads at that hour on a Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, sorry. Anyhow. Except maybe a few deer raiding the gardens. He shut his mouth abruptly. In his relief, he was close to babbling. There was a moment's silence. The two troopers were now looking at the floor. Pangborn had an expression on his face Thad could not read. He didn't believe he had ever seen it before. Not chagrin, although chagrin was a part of it.
What in the fuck is going on here? Well, that's very convenient, Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said at last, but it's a long way from rock solid. We've got the word of you and your wife, or guesstimate, as to when you saw this last couple out. If they were as blasted as you seem to think, they'll hardly be able to corroborate what you've said. And if this De Lesseps fellow really is a friend, he might say, well, who knows? All the same, Alan Pangborn was losing steam. Thad saw it and believed, no, knew, the state troopers did too. Yet the man wasn't ready to let it go. The fear Thad had felt initially and the anger which had followed it were changing to fascination and curiosity. He thought he had never seen puzzlement and certainty so equally at war. The fact of the party, and he must accept as fact something which could so easily be checked, had shaken him, but not convinced him. Nor, he saw, were the troopers entirely convinced. The only difference was that the troopers weren't so hot under the collar. They hadn't known Homer Gamache personally, and so they didn't have any personal stake in this. Alan Pangborn had, and did. I knew him too, Thad thought. So maybe I have a stake in it too. Apart from my hide, that is. Look, he said patiently, keeping his gaze locked with Pangborn's and trying not to return hostility in kind. Let's get real, as my students like to say. You asked if we could effectively prove our whereabouts. Your whereabouts, Mr. Beaumont, Pangborn said. Okay, my whereabouts. 5 pretty difficult hours, hours when most people are in bed. Thanks to nothing more than blind luck, I, if you prefer, can cover at least 3 of those 5 hours. Maybe Raleigh and his odious lady friend left at 2, maybe they left at 1:30 or 2:15. Whenever it was late. They'll corroborate that, and the Burke's woman wouldn't lie me an alibi even if Raleigh would. I think if Billy Burke saw me washed up drowning on the beach, she'd throw a bucket of water on me. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.